Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to continue to talk about danger. The danger that's inherent when we try and do something that we have wanted to do but have been unable to do. And the danger inherent in discovering that actually we are more than we thought we were. The danger that's there when we try to demonstrate qualities we've been pretending we didn't have. The danger called catastrophic expectations. And I'm going to play an interview I did with two delightful actors, a married couple, Chris Danforth and Sam Osheroff. So, hang on. Here come the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering who you really are and then becoming it. If you've been listening, then you've heard me say over and over again that it's my experience as a psychotherapist with over 30 years of practice that almost none of us is really who they really are. All of us figured out in childhood what did and didn't work in our family of origin, either what they told us we had to be or what we intuited they wanted from us or what they told us we were, even if that wasn't how we were acting. Or in some cases, as I pointed out in earlier shows, there were circumstances that demonstrated stuff for us that taught us things about ourselves. So if you were slow to develop physically and you walked slowly, perhaps it took you a long time to walk or to talk, you might have gotten labeled with the idea that you were slow. Either, you know, that you were not physically adept, oh, you know, he or she's just not an athlete, or, oh, he's slow, you know, Debbie does everything slowly, or even that you were not that bright. And none of this may be actually true of you. As you developed, you may have turned into someone with a very athletic body. You may be very, very smart. But that cover, that label, that idea of who you are may have a profound influence on what you think about yourself. And, ironically, even labels which we don't particularly like, we are reluctant to give up if they are the identity that our family thinks we are. I've talked about this at length in earlier shows. If you're interested, you can go to my website, thelynnshow.com. That's one word, thelynne.com. Oh, I'm sorry. I left out the show part, The Lynn Show. But don't leave out the E. thelynneshow.com. That's my website. And although a lot of things on my website are correct, for example, the podcasts that are up there are actually the podcasts, and the book from which all this material comes is actually the book, the time of the show is wrong. The show used to be on at 1 o'clock on Tuesdays, but if you're listening to me now, you know it's on at 2 o'clock on Tuesdays. I deeply apologize for my inability to change my website. Everything I've had to do with this show is a learning curve, and I just haven't been able to figure out the learning curve for the website, and I am in between web people. So hopefully that will be corrected soon. So if you tell anybody about the show, please tell them it's on at 2 o'clock, not at 1 o'clock. So you can get all that information, the earlier information about cover story and undercover, if you either weren't listening to the show then or you were but you would like some refresher about that. This information can be really difficult to hold on to, I know. In any case, the end result of whatever it is that happened in our childhood, what I like to call the legacy of our childhood, is that I want to say all of us, although I hate to generalize. Okay, most of us, the lion's share of us, believe things about ourselves which are just not true. And we keep a secret about ourselves, not only from the rest of the world, but from ourselves as well. Perhaps you also keep secrets about yourself that you know about. I'm dyslexic, and for many, many years, I pretended to be able to do things that I couldn't do because I was deeply embarrassed and thought that the fact that I reversed numbers and that my geographical skills were non-existent meant something terrible about me. So one of the things I had to discover about myself was that my dyslexia was not my fault, and it didn't say anything about how smart I am or how valuable I am or how much you should love me. And so I did become able to present that who I am. But that's an example of something I knew about myself all the time and chose to keep a secret. There are other, many, many, many other things that we keep as a secret because we don't know better. And it is the thrust of this show to help you to first consider the possibility that there are aspects of yourself that either you're keeping a secret, the way I was keeping my dyslexia a secret, or that maybe there are parts of yourself that you don't even know about. And so that you keep them a secret from others, you keep them a secret from yourself, and what that means is that you are unable to use them. You're unable to benefit from them. So just to take the example of the person who thought that they were slow, maybe they didn't go to college. Maybe they wanted to go to college, but they believed the myth that they were too slow, when it really wasn't true. So, one of the things I'm going to talk about today is I've been continuing to talk about the danger in discovering who you really are. The danger in making a change in your life that you want to make. It is not the conventional wisdom that what stops us from making changes in our life and discovering who we really are, that one of the reasons we don't do that is that there's a danger, again, an unrecognized danger that we that gets in our way. So I've been talking about that, and I'm going to continue to talk about that today. And if you've been listening, you know that when I interview people who make their living and or their life with their art, and I talk about shows that are currently being played in Sarasota, Florida at various venues. And today, later, I'm going to interview a couple who are actors and appearing, luckily for them, in two character plays at the Oslo Theater in Sarasota, Florida. But before I do that, I'm going to talk a little bit more about danger. Actually, I'm going to talk about catastrophic expectations. You may know exactly what you want to happen when you make a desired change or when you discover something about yourself and you want to express it. You want to demonstrate it. But no one can know. No one can precisely predict the outcome of an action they have not yet taken. When we can't forecast the result of a change that we want to make, when we can't predict what's going to happen when we demonstrate a quality which we have been hiding, we can imagine the consequence, however. And when we think about the outcome of a difficult change or the demonstration of a previously hidden quality, most of us envision our worst-case scenario, our catastrophic expectations. Catastrophic expectations stem from the belief that the worst thing that can happen will happen. And real or imagined catastrophic expectations have the power to keep us from changing. Recently, I was helping a man who wanted to apply for a job for which he is incredibly well skilled and prepared. But every time he tried to make an appointment, something got in his way. He forgot the telephone number. Sometimes he made the appointment and forgot to go. He tried to dial the number, but his fingers got caught. I mean, he could not make himself do it. And we had to look into his history. And what we found in his history was a very, very critical parent. A parent who demonstrated for him over and over in concrete and in indirect ways that he would fail, that he was a disappointment, that he wasn't smart enough. Ironically, for me, this client is also dyslexic. And so early on, he made terrific mistakes. He had trouble learning to read. He couldn't do some of the things that were that other people could do easily. And his parent was just awful to him. Now, it turned out that while reading and writing and words were a little difficult for him, math was a whiz. He was a whiz. He was brilliant, and it was a natural, easy thing for him. But he had gotten in his head that there was something wrong with him. So this job that he wanted to apply for, it was all about math. It was all about numbers. He's completely able to do this job, but when we did the little exercise in which I had him envision applying for the job, he saw not the interviewer on the other side of the table, but his parent. And so you can see that he had a catastrophic expectation that this interviewer would see him the way his parent saw him and would criticize him and not want him. And the pain of those early experiences was so severe that he was completely willing not to risk going up for that interview. And so his unconscious protected him from this catastrophic expectation. Now, this was a catastrophic expectation that was clear. When we did this exercise, he could feel the terror, and he could see his father's face on the interviewer's head. But he hadn't been aware of it until we did that exercise. He was hiding from himself his catastrophic expectation. This is a very, very common gift of our unconscious. before we are able to tolerate knowing what it is that's stopping us, our unconscious keeps that information from us. So, now it's your turn. It's your opportunity to consider, what is it that you have been afraid to do? In this case, it was not only that he was apprehensive about putting himself in the position of being turned down. In this case, there was even a deeper thing going on. If he got the job, if he was successful at it, that would put the lie to the belief that he was somehow inadequate. He would then be forced at least to consider that all those years of thinking of himself as inadequate, as a disappointment, as a failure, were somehow wrong. He would have to start thinking of himself as someone who could succeed, as someone who was talented, and that would run right up against what he knew to be his father's idea about him. I'm going to talk more about this and the confronting of the person who believes you are what you've been pretending to be in later shows. But right now, I'm hoping that you're going to explore this for yourself. Is there something you want to do that you know you want to do but you've had trouble doing? Have had trouble making yourself do or taking the risk to do? Do you think that this thing requires you to be somebody you're not sure you can be? Are you sure this is somebody you're not? Do other people think of you in this way? Would someone else be surprised, annoyed, disappointed, threatened if it turned out that you could actually do this thing? Just ask yourself. Don't do anything else. This is very, very challenging work, and we want to go very, very slowly. So, again, think about the things you want to do that you've been stuck. Think about the characteristics you wish you had. Ask yourself whether some of the things you want to do might, you think, require something you don't think you could do but you want to do. And is there anyone else who has a vested interest in you staying the person who can't do it? Just ask. Just wonder. Just be curious. Okay. In just a little while, I'm going to play the interview that I did with Chris Danforth and Sam Osheroff. But before I do that, I'm going to play a public service announcement, and then I'm going to talk about the shows that Chris and Sam are in and how delightful it is to get an opportunity to talk to two people who are as passionate about the work that they do as Chris and Sam are. So here's the public service announcement, and after my introduction, the interview.
Is Mommy going to be here, Grandma?
I'm sure she'll be here, sweetheart. She's not picking up.
She can't be doing this again. She already missed her birthday dinner. She can't miss the first recital.
Do you think our daughter is drinking again?
Missed holidays, skipped milestones. Problem drinking hurts families and friends, but there's help and hope. Al-Anon family groups are for anyone troubled by someone else's drinking. Whether you're a grandparent, parent, spouse, or partner, before you can help the problem drinker, you need to help yourself first. For an Al-Anon family group meeting in your community, call 1-888-4-ALANON. That's 1-888-425-2666. Online, visit www.alanonfamilygroups.org. A message from Al-Anon Family Groups.
As you know, if you've been listening, I like to interview people who make their living or their life within art. So I interview dancers and writers and actors and directors and fine artists and sculptors and people who have dedicated their life to an art form. as I have said many times, the reason I do this is because in order to dedicate your life to an art, it has to be who you really are. There are other cultures in which one can have one's art as a part of one's life. And it doesn't seem strange, and it isn't criticized or blown out of proportion. But in our culture, in order to give your life to an art in one way or another, either as a living or, you know, to make a living, that is to make, you know, money, or simply as a way of being in the world, it really has to be who you are. We don't make it easy for our artists in this culture. The only artists that are able to support themselves, as a general rule, are those who have been very successful, very famous. I've forgotten what the statistic is, but it's something really bizarre, like 6% or 8% of the people who are part of Actors Equity actually make a living from their acting. So to have dedicated your life to this, you really have to, it has to be integral to you. It has to be who you are. And I interview these people because when you listen to actors, dancers, writers, directors talk about their work, you know that at least in this area of their life, we are talking to exactly who they are. And since this show is all about becoming who you are, finding who you are, locating who you are, and then letting yourself be it in the world, I have found that talking to artists is a way to see it. They're poster children for being who you really are. One of my favorite things to do is to interview couples, both of whom make their living and or their life with an art form. And I've been lucky enough to have interviewed people for whom the theater is, the theater is their art. Interview people who one of them is a sculptor and the other is a musician. Couples who both were musicians. And today I'm going to play interviews that I did with people who are married and both of whom are actors and are lucky enough to be performing as I speak in two character plays at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. These two people are Chris Stanford and Sam Osaroff. They are, as I said, married, and they both studied at the Oslo Repertory Theater where they met many years ago. And Michael Edwards, who's the executive creative director of the Oslo, and who, if you were listening last week, I interviewed about the show Galileo. There's a wonderful, wonderful season here this year, and I hope that everybody who's listening to me either has seen the plays or is going to see them, because they are really, really different and each in their own way pretty terrific. So today I'm talking to Chris and Sam, who are in 5 Years After, which is a show about the way a relationship turns into a marriage and ends all in a 5-year period. It's very, very clever. The characters don't ever speak directly to each other. You'll hear Sam talk about that at the end of the interview. And they're singing. The songs are wonderful. The lyrics are clever. And Kathy, who is the woman, her songs take the relationship from the end to the beginning, and the man's songs all take the relationship from the beginning to the end, and of course they cross in the middle, and you can see what happens and how it's happening, and it's just beautifully done, and they are terrific. In the second show, it's Searching for Eden, which you will hear me ask about during the show, during the interview, because I wasn't sure, is taken from the same source material that the musical Apple Tree was taken from. That is a short story by Mark Twain. And the first act takes place in Eden and comes right out of that material. And you see the striking, startling, adorable, humorous, interesting difference between men and women. The second half, which is completely original, playwright took the material and then went in his own direction with it, shows you this couple in modern-day dress many years later, very, very long into their relationship. Again, this is another interesting look at what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to couple, where the stressors are, where the challenges are, where the delights are. And this would be an these would be interesting plays to see if anybody did them. But when you are lucky enough to have not only two very good actors and good singers, but a couple who is actually married, then that kicks this into a much higher level. You get what you get on the stage you cannot possibly get with people who don't know each other, no matter how good they are as actors. There's an ease, there's a comfort, there's an intimacy that they bring to this. They can't actually help bringing to it because of their personal relationship, how long and well they know each other. And you'll hear some of that in the interview. I interview Chris first, and then I interview Sam, also alone, and then I interview the two of them. And we talk not only about the shows they're in, but what it means to be an actor, what it means to spend your life as an actor, and what it means to have married an actor. And so here, first you'll hear me and Chris, then me and Sam, then me and Chris and Sam. And here we are now. Okay, so I'm here with Chris Stanford in the kitchen?
The green room.
Is this the green room?
This is, even though it's not green, this is the green room.
I see, in the green room of the Oslo. And Chris has just literally run off stage. and she's appearing in Searching for Eden. And for the show, I interview people who make their living or their life with their art. And I ask everybody the same question.
Okay.
How did it happen to you? How did you find it? How did you know? When did you know?
It was never, like, lightning striking for me. It was just sort of this gradual thing. I got into theater, like a lot of people in high school, you know, and I was making the decision between psychology or music or musical theater. And I was like, well, I kind of like musical theater the best out of any of those, so I'm going to do that. So I did that for undergrad, and then that led to some work post-undergrad, and then that led to me thinking, you know, I think I'd like to go to grad school. And then I did that, and then that led to me working professionally. So it's just sort of, it's been a snowball more than anything.
Well, do you remember as a kid having any interest in this?
I do.
Tell me.
My brother was, he's 7 years older, and I remember watching him do shows, things like that, with high school drama club, and I was so enamored of the whole experience, but I was much, much too shy, I felt, to get involved, and I didn't want to follow in his footsteps and do that whole thing, so I sort of avoided it for a long time, even though I was amazed by it, and I think, obviously, a large part of me wanted to do it, but I remember that very clearly. I remember him in Fiddler on the Roof.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And so it was a kind of pull towards, pull away, right? That's terrific, that's shining, but that's not, but I don't know that I can do it.
Or I was very shy.
Very shy.
Yeah.
So is your brother the only other sibling you have?
Yeah.
7 years?
Yeah.
And did he go on to do?
Well, he worked, he went to undergrad, the same place that I went for theater, and then he moved to New York and did the actor thing for a while, and then he actually decided he wanted to go to grad school for journalism, so he went a different path.
Okay, so so at 7, 8, 9, 10, you were drawn to it but scared of it. And then somehow in high school, what happened that...
Well, in I think, you know, I was in middle school plays and things like that.
How did that happen? I mean, do you remember why?
Well, I always sang. I always sang, and I started dancing when I was 3. So I was a dancer, and I always liked to sing. But I don't know, in middle school, just by virtue of being involved in chorus and stuff like that, you audition and you get cast as...
Right, and it didn't seem like that big a deal.
Mm-mm.
Right, it
no.
was... it Right, and so it was kind of a gentle...
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It was
right.
a gentle introduction.
Right.
And then, even freshman year of high school, I was still kind of shying away from it, and then I decided sophomore year, well, I'll try it. And I had been taking private lessons, voice lessons by that point. And I got a lead in my sophomore year, so...
And there you were.
There I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was fun.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Very
yeah,
much.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So Searching for Eden is not a musical.
No. No, it's not.
No.
I got, in undergrad, I mean, I was primarily doing musical theater. That's what my degree is in undergrad, anyway. And I got a great education, especially in the music world, music department. And I felt that I really wanted to go back, knowing that, go back and concentrate in a conservatory setting on the acting part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been wonderful, and I feel like I feel strong in both areas,
mm-hmm.
and I'm really glad that I did. It's
yeah.
opened up a lot of opportunities for me.
So. Well, you're wonderful in this play.
Thank
Absolutely
you.
Absolutely wonderful.
Thanks.
Okay, so I think maybe I'll spend a little time with Sam,
yeah.
and then I'll talk to the two of you.
Sure.
Okay, good. So I'm going to stop this now. Okay, so now here I am with Sam Osheroff, equally of Searching for Eden.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you what I told Chris. I do this radio show, internet radio show.
Okay.
And I interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
Ah, okay.
And I ask them all the same question, and that is, how did you find it? Or how did it find you? Or how did it happen? Or how did it start?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I think it found me.
Tell me.
Well, I did my first show when I was about 8 years old.
Really? Tell me.
I played an orphan in a very bad school production of Oliver, and was over the moon. I had nothing to do in it at all, really. It was in the background, and I loved it. and then didn't do anything again until high school.
Well, wait, back up. How did that happen? I mean, you had to go up for it, right?
No, I grew up in Europe a little bit.
And where?
In Luxembourg, of all the strange places. Yeah, and we went to a little American school, and they decided to do a school production. So there was no audition or anything. It was just something we did.
Oh, and they said, and was everybody in it?
Yeah, everybody was in it.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it wasn't the beginning of my professional career.
I see. So it came to you then.
Yeah,
right?
It really did. And I just loved it. And then for some reason didn't really have an opportunity to do anything for a number of years after that, and then got cast in a small play in high school when it was not cool at all, and I remember being very embarrassed, not telling my friends about it.
You were too macho for it?
Yeah.
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 Okay, where are you living now?
Right now?
No.
Oh, at that point, I was living in Vermont.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so from Luxembourg to Vermont, and then...
And what was the show?
God, I can't even remember. It was a little one-act play,
wow.
So really nothing, but it was a long, long time ago.
So now... Did your friends know when you were in it?
They found out, yeah. And they were totally cool about it. In fact, they thought it was cool.
Oh,
so, but it took me a long time to say, hey, guys, I'm kind of in a play here. and, you know, it's funny now because now that we have Facebook and all this, media stuff where you can connect with people, I get all these messages from people I went to high school with at one point saying, how's your career going? God, you were so great.
Oh, wow.
You know, all these people I thought were laughing at me in high school are actually really into it. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's kind of cool to hear that these days.
I'll bet it is.
Yeah.
And also, it's an interesting, it's an interesting sort of tug of war, you know, I mean, because I'm assuming you had that sort of boy thing that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that acting is not necessarily a boy thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is funny because... It really is.
Yeah.
Now these days. It really is. I mean, you know, there's a lot of very cool macho boy actors out there who are
right,
very
right.
tough guys.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right. That's
yeah.
right. So, okay, so all right. So now you're in high school and you do this little one act. Then what happened?
And that was it. That was the beginning of it. I never stopped after that. I started going off to theater.
Oh, you
camp.
Took it seriously.
Yeah, I took it seriously after that. Yeah. So I was probably about 14 at that point, and from then on, I went to in the summers, I went to Boston University theater program and stuff like that, and, you know, built and went to... I decided in undergrad to go to get a good education rather than go to conservatory, so I got a good liberal arts education at Bates College.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, just sort of plowed into it, and I did about 8 years in New York City, and then I left at that point, and I said, you know what, this is tough, I can't do it. They say, if you can do anything else, go do it.
Yeah.
So I tried, I went off, and I went to, silly enough, I went to art school, and then became a painter, yeah.
Sorry,
I was like, oh, that's tough, so I'm going to try something
even
more tough.
Even more difficult.
Yeah.
Right.
And I realized that as much as I love painting, I don't like spending time alone in the studio. So I came back to acting, and I said at that point, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to really do it. So I went to grad school and got my degree and really plowed ahead and met my wife at the same time. Yeah.
Your family, at 14 to have decided to do this as a career, did they like it? Did they mention it?
They liked it. I think they were always supportive of me. My parents are divorced. My mom and my stepdad are very supportive. My dad tried to sort of get me to do a secondary career in computers or something that would make me money.
Fall back on?
Yeah, which I didn't take seriously at all, and I should have, probably. Because, you know, when you're an actor, you have to be making money. You have to have a life. You mm-hmm. have to, you know, have a good place to live, and you have to be eating 3 meals a day. Otherwise, you really can't do it. It's too tough.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a boxer training. If you're not eating and you're not in good shape, you're not going to go into the ring and have a good fight. And
right,
it's the same
right.
thing. So
yeah, people don't realize how much energy it takes.
Oh, it takes so much energy.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that you're, you know, most people go and they interview for a job and they get their job and they keep that job for a number of years or decades or a lifetime, right?
Yeah.
We do that every couple of weeks or months. We go, we interview for a job, we get the job, it's over, we go back, we interview for another job, we
right.
don't get the job, we don't get the next job, we don't get the next job, we don't get the next one, eventually we get another one, it ends. Yeah, so it's constantly like finding a new job, and it takes a lot of stamina.
Yes, it does.
Yeah,
so yeah.
The person who stays the longest gets the work eventually.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
But anybody smart
yeah.
says, this is ridiculous, I gotta get out of here, you know. So, yeah.
Well, you're wonderful in this play.
Thank you.
Okay, I think maybe what I'll do is spend a little time with the two of you.
Sure.
If that's okay, you want to go get
yeah.
Chris and bring her back?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I have Chris and Sam. And why don't you tell me how this play happened for you? Did you hear about this? Did you audition for it? Did you...
No.
This is a little gift that was handed to us.
It's a gift, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We're both graduates of the conservatory here, so we know Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a while ago, not this past fall, but the fall before, he called us up and said that he was going to be coming to New York, which is where we're based.
Mm-hmm.
And he got together with us, and he wanted to hear some songs from the last 5 years, and he had this script that he wanted us to read from. And we did. And it all worked out. And we didn't. That was our only audition, and it was really a non-audition. It was just sort of, let's all get together and
hang out in the studio and sing a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty easy, actually. It was really a gift, and we get to work together. On two-person shows, which is really nice.
We haven't talked at all about the last 5 years. Is it hard for you to go back and forth?
It's hard physically. More than in vocally right now.
Yeah.
This is a really physical show.
Right, and the other one is...
It's really
vocal. Oh, my God,
dynamic.
Yes, you're working
yeah.
so hard.
Yeah.
And this one is very... I find this one is very vocally demanding.
Yeah, well, you're talking all the time.
I talk so much.
That's right.
So by
That's
the time
right.
I get over, you know, to the last 5 years, I'm just... my voice was so shot the other day.
Yeah,
I was
we did a double day yesterday. We did Eden in the afternoon, then we did a last 5 years in the
You're kidding.
Evening. And we had a little bit of a frog in our throats. It worked out, but it was, you know, it was definitely, we could feel it.
Well, I mean, my God, you're singing all the time,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
It's so challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So did you know how hard this was going to be? Or did you just say, oh, sure, we'll do that?
You know, we had an idea, but you never know until you're really in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We looked at the schedule, so we had some idea that it was going to be really, really, really crazy. But,
yeah,
it's one thing looking at it on paper, and it's another thing living through it.
I'm in Galileo, too. So I have a small part in Galileo. So this week, I have a 9-show week. Next week, I have a 10-show week. So 19 shows in 14 days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've interviewed other people who are doing, you know, roles in same and, you know, in different places at the same time. But I have to say that I think you guys have the most challenging
We have the heaviest workload this year, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, you really do. Yeah. And you guys are wonderful in both of them.
Thank you.
So now, tell me, because I'm not quite sure, how long are they running? Because you're closing in on the end of them, aren't you?
Yeah, we've got 10 more Edens left, and then we've got a bunch of last 5 years. Last 5 years runs all the way through the end of February.
And
Eden runs... It closes just shortly before that. I can't remember the date.
They have their 20s.
Okay, all right. So, okay, I will talk more about the show before and after I do the interviews. But I do want to say, come out and see these two plays.
Please.
Really, they're wonderful, and it's really interesting to see. I mean, because they're both two-character plays, I mean, the other people that I've interviewed, they may have a very challenging role, but there are a lot of other people in it, and then in the other shows they're in, they're not, you know, center stage. You guys are carrying both of them. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Say that to Michael Edwards. Michael Edwards for carrying two shows.
I will.
Yeah. It's actually wonderful. It's a lot of work, and we're tired, but, you know, that's...
I know, it's what you do.
It's what we do.
Yeah, right? I know.
You know? As long as our voices hold up.
Yeah, and your bodies.
Our bodies hold up, yeah.
Yeah, right. Better than the gym is what you guys are doing.
Yeah, well, you know, if I can get through Eden, that run of Eden, without twisting an ankle or...
All that jumping up and down out of the tree. Yeah. I was thinking about that when I was watching it and thinking how well you did.
And the floor is wet, so it's...
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And actually, I was thinking about that when I was watching 5 years. You're jumping up and down on those things, you know, on the set, you know.
On the rake stage.
Yes, right. And it's not, you know, you do it great. I mean, you know, you do it as though it's not tough.
Yeah.
That's easier than climbing that tree, I'll tell you that much.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, it doesn't look like that.
Good.
Yeah, it doesn't look like that. I'm glad for you. Okay, I like to ask people, two things when I'm talking to people who are married. It's a special challenge to be married to somebody who does what you do, and to be married to somebody who's an actor. You know, a painter married to a dancer, it's a different thing, but two actors, I mean, that can be really challenging.
Yeah.
So would you talk a little bit about that? I mean, just anything that comes to mind?
Well, just in terms of very practical logistics, it's difficult because a lot of times... I mean, this is a rare occasion, us getting to be together.
Right.
Most of the time, work will take you out of town.
Right.
And there's the long distance to contend with. And
the past two seasons, Chris has been down here in Florida working at the Oslo, and I've been up in New York in the wintertime. So that, you know, those were tough winters.
Yes. Really. Yeah.
It's actually, in a lot of ways, works out kind of well when we're both together, because we're on the same schedule, and we know what's expected. We know that we're, you know, if you're not in this business, and you have a spouse who is, and you may not get it unless you experience it. Why are you always having to rush off to do that? Why are you always working on something? And we know what's expected. So in a way, it works out better.
It's funny, because in 5 years, that's a problem for them.
Yeah.
You know, and the other problem, which is one is working, the other isn't, one is doing better than the other, one is being disappointed, the other one can't support the other one, is all that stuff's interesting that you're doing that.
Yeah.
You know.
All that happens.
I mean, all that happens is exactly right.
Yeah.
You're never doing equally well at the same time.
Right.
Or rarely ever.
Right. And so it's really an added challenge to the relationship. To which, of course, you don't pull off in the middle in 5 years.
Yeah,
you know?
5 years collapses under the weight of that.
Under the weight of that. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
How was that for you guys to play that? I mean,
it's funny because that people ask us that a lot, and for me, I don't know about you, but we don't actually, even though we're talking to each other all the time on stage, we're not physically on stage together talking. You can explain to your audience what I mean by that. But so we don't actually play out those scenes together. We're playing out with imaginary partners on stage who, you know, obviously I'm thinking of Chris most of the time. Not all the time, because sometimes it doesn't, you know, Kathy's behavior doesn't suit her, so I've got to find a substitution.
Right.
So it's not like we're up there battling it out together every night.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, but it does bring up that That is something that you guys have to be aware of.
And it happens, you know. I mean, there were those two winters when Chris was down here working in sunny Florida doing great plays, and I was up in New York not working, and it was 25,000 degrees below zero.
And
the sun was setting about quarter after noon every day.
Right.
That was tough.
Yeah,
and
it was tough.
I had a hard time with that. I had to keep reminding myself, you know, I've had seasons where I've been out. You know, this summer I was down here working at the band and doing Fat Pig, and Chris was stuck in New York. So we know that it always will even out. And if it doesn't, you know, at least one of us is making money.
You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking that in 5 years, Chris's Kathy, it's her self-esteem that causes the crash.
Yeah.
Is that she can't tolerate.
She can't support Jamie in his success.
Well, she can't. Right. She can't bear.
Yeah.
You know, because she sees it as a reflection of her.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think that's the challenge.
Yeah.
Is not to, well, no, I don't want to say, I suppose I want to say it another way, which is to continue to be able to feed your own ego, whether you're the one who's working or not, whether the other one is doing really well and you're not,
right.
But to not to make it the job of the other one to make you feel okay.
Yes.
You know.
It's a trap. It definitely
is. It is a trap.
I mean, you know, I think we've both fallen into that, probably me more than you, because I've had more opportunity to, but yeah, it's tricky. You always have to remember that somebody else's career has nothing to do with your career.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just, you know, somebody you're married to, it's everybody you know. I mean, we obviously know a ton of actors.
Right.
And some of them waltz out of grad school and get booked in huge projects immediately, and you just sort of bite your tongue and go, that's great, I'm happy for them. That has nothing to do with me.
Right. I really think that is the point.
Yeah.
To find, you know, forgive me, I mean, you didn't ask for this, but, you know, to find whatever it is that feeds you, because it's not just actors. I mean, and it isn't only just people who are married to, you know, to actors who, actually, I'm thinking about a friend of mine who had a lot of success very young. She had a lot of success, and then it just disappeared.
Hmm.
And so for, I don't know, 20, 30 years, you know, she's working little jobs, doing rep, getting nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then she got a really great role, and instead of being happy for her, her friends were pissed.
Really?
It's really, really tough.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, people don't realize, if you're not an actor or a writer or a dancer or whatever, you know, what a challenge it is to keep that thing inside of yourself strong, so that you can continue to do the thing.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it's any of the arts are tough enough on their own.
Yes.
And once you start having to do that comparison stuff, it makes it even harder.
The business, you know, the business of the art. I mean, it's
tough.
Challenging to keep your inspiration alive in the face of all
the
other stuff.
Any couple in any profession might have a little bit of professional competition or envy or jealousy, but you have a little more control over your career in other places, and you can get more satisfaction just out of the work. We don't have that. I mean, we have to wait for someone to give us the work first.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah, if people who are not in the arts don't have a clue.
Yeah.
You know, you're a lawyer, somebody hires you, you're an accountant. You know, there's a formula. That's right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the chances are good you'll get the job. You'll keep the job.
Yeah.
If you do the skill well, the chances are good you'll work.
Right.
That's not true with actors.
It's not a meritocracy here.
No, it isn't.
No.
It isn't. That's really true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we also a little bit. You know, actors have a little more ego. I mean, that's, you know, in the last 5 years, Jamie's totally full of himself.
Yes, he is.
Love,
that's right.
You know,
he doesn't know what to do.
He's 23, but he gets everything that he could ever dream of. He gets a review in The New Yorker.
Right.
A great review, and he's, you know, over the moon about it. So.
Right. And he can't understand. He doesn't have any sympathy for her.
Yeah.
Because he...
Well, I think he does have sympathy for her, but I think he understands eventually that he can't, as he said, he can't rescue you.
No, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, that is right. He does seem to hold on to that for... it's interesting. In both of the... I mean, maybe you won't agree with me, but in both of the plays, the women are a little less attractive than the men. Hmm. Do you not think it?
How do you mean? It's hard when we're in the play to make that...
Well, I don't mean that you aren't.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And I mean that, you know, Kathy is the one who falls apart.
Oh, yeah.
And he tries.
But you got to see, I mean, Jamie has a lot of appeal because he's super energetic and he's successful, but, you know, he eventually does some very bad stuff, too. I mean, he's the one who has an affair.
Yeah, no, he does bad stuff, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah, he doesn't follow.
He doesn't fall apart. Right. He doesn't fall apart.
Yeah.
And in the end, I mean, it's the very first song,
mm-hmm.
you know, you know, Jamie has found something better and I'm still hurting.
Yeah.
It's something like that, right?
Basically.
Right. And that's how it ends.
Yeah.
Right. So, and she starts out with all that promise, you know,
yeah.
and all that passion,
mm-hmm.
And then it beats her down.
Yep.
You know, right. And in Eden, she's harder than he is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
She's just a harder, she has a hard edge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just interesting.
Particularly in the second act.
Yes.
I mean, it's
yes, that's
in
right.
Eden, it's sort of this interesting flip-flop, you know, I'm the one in the first act that's trying
right.
to engage him and,
right.
you know, come with me, come with
right,
me,
right,
you know?
Right.
And for most of it, he's
yeah.
saying no, no, no,
no, no, no, no.
The
right.
exact opposite happening in the second act.
That's right, that's
yeah.
right.
But you don't get that hard edge with Adam in the first act because it's much more whimsical and comic, even though I'm doing the same thing.
Right.
Was this what the apple tree was taken from?
Yes.
Yeah.
Apple tree is taken from Mark Twain's diaries of Adam and Eve, not
it's
from
the same
this
source
play.
Material. This play was.
Based this was all came from the same source.
Yeah,
yeah.
So the first act is all is basically
all
verbatim. He's modernized it a little bit.
Yeah,
he chopped it up and rearranged
yeah.
it, but it's all Mark Twain. The
yeah.
second act is all original.
Right.
But yeah. Same source material.
Did you guys ever do it?
No.
I've sung a song from it, but
you know they just did it here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw the reviews. We weren't around for it. We were
yeah,
back in New York.
Yeah.
For it. Yeah. In fact, I think some review mentioned that, like, oh, they just did the apple tree, and now you can come see.
Oh, very clever.
Yeah.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, do you guys want to say anything about what it's like? I mean, we've talked a lot about this, so if there's anything else that is on your mind, what it's like to make a life, to try and make a life of your art, just think about it for a second. If there's anything I didn't ask you or anything that comes to mind.
I think it's a challenge, but it's also a privilege. You know, I think there's a lot of people who are very happy in their work who are off doing office work and are doing their thing. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really feel like I have a choice. I do have a job in New York, a corporate job that I do. I do corporate coaching, which is kind of performance. I use all my acting skills, but that's how we make our money, and Chris was just hired with the same company. But the idea of going, you know, the idea of being taking a 4-month contract down in Florida to do 3 plays is who gets to do that? You know, it's phenomenal. It's
yeah.
it's hard. It's a lot of work. We probably work 60, 70 hours a week. But I wouldn't do anything else. Would
yeah.
you?
No.
We're gonna eventually, you know, have a baby sometime soon. We'll have to take a little break and, you know, get some money.
Yeah, I guess that's necessary.
Where do you guys live?
We live in Harlem in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see when we get back whether we're gonna stick around in that neighborhood or move out to the suburbs or something.
Yeah.
We're trying to find a happy medium. You know, New York is great, but it's a tough place to live. Nice place to visit. Wouldn't want to live there.
Yeah.
You know?
Cool. Anyway, you guys are wonderful.
Thank you.
And I will talk about the play and hopefully we'll get people out to see you.
Terrific.
And there you have it, Chris and Sam. Their commitment to their work, to each other, so clear, so adorable. And as I said in the introduction, you can see that bond that there is between them in everything that happens in these two shows, and the shows are adorable. So as I promised, I've talked about the shows, and I'm hoping that you will come out to see them. And you may have noticed that I've been interviewing a lot of actors who are in shows at the Oslo Repertory Theater at the moment. At the moment, there are some terrific shows at the Oslo Repertory Theater, and I encourage you to go out and see them. I will be interviewing in the near future the actors in both The Perfume Shop and Hearts. One, a very touching and funny and good-feeling play, and the other, a deeply interesting and engrossing and stimulating play. And so I hope that you will listen to those interviews and go and see those plays, because both of them are terrific. Okay, so, and I will continue to talk about danger and becoming who you really are and all the things that I talk about on this show. I haven't said in a while, I don't think, so if you want to talk to me, I do all of my psychotherapy on the phone. And you can reach me by going to the website, thelynnshow.com, and clicking on email me and saying I'd like to talk to you. And, of course, give me a telephone number and I'll call you. Or you can comment on anything that you hear on the show or ask any questions or for clarification or just anything you might want to say to me. And as always, I have to thank Josh Hackney, who not only makes this show possible and make it sound as good as it can sound. I can't blame Josh for what I say, but how I say it or how you hear it is entirely Josh. And in addition to that, I just want to say that my hard drive died, and Josh recovered everything, put it all back. So I was a little bit slow last month. I wasn't sure what I was going to get on the air or not, but Josh to the rescue. So if you've got any issues with your hardware, your software, your internet, your web, your computer, your recording, your electronics, you want Josh. I mean, he is the man. And you can reach him by going to my website, thelynnshow.com. Don't forget the E in Lynn. And clicking on email me and say, I need Josh. So, as always, I hope that you heard something you can use in this show. Something you either didn't know or knew but forgot. Something that got you thinking. Something that made you laugh. Something that, well, you know, something that'll bring you back. Because I'll be back next week, same time, same station. And I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix